ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I'm speaking to my phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, if you think democracy is no longer delivering, would you prefer a wise monarch to rule? Well, that was the conclusion reached by one of the biggest thinkers of all time back in the world's first democracy in 5th century Athens. So at a time when democracy is in decline across the world, today on Big Ideas, let's regroup.
It is amazing what the Greeks achieved. We owe a great debt of gratitude towards those people in that part of the world at that time for what they achieved and what they gave the world. When Greece was seeking independence from Turkey, a lot of the Western thinkers said, we owe these people a huge debt of gratitude because they invented democracy and they invented these institutions and they invented the rule of law. Now, whether all that's open to challenge, nevertheless, that's the spirit of this. We owe them a great debt of gratitude.
Hello, it's Natasha Mitchell. This is ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. Welcome. Today, the Irish scholar Dr. David Horan, leader of the School of Philosophy and Economic Science in Ireland, a member of the Plato Centre at Trinity College Dublin. He has spent the past 16 years translating the complete works of Plato from ancient Greek to English. He is the first individual to do that in 150 years. What a task, mammoth. Well, the result is the two-volume The Dialogues of Plato. And as you're about to hear, Plato was no fan of democracy, but many of his thoughts on the subject have echoed throughout the two millennia since, from 19th century Russia to contemporary South Africa to the rise of right-wing populism today. Plato is relevant. And Dr. Horan joins you today from the lands of the Ku-ring-gai and Darug peoples in northern Sydney at the School of Practical Philosophy. Let's go meet him.
Good greetings to you all. Very good to be with you. The title of this lecture is Democracy and Its Opposite. And I'd just like to begin by telling you about an email I got yesterday. I came back from the book launch and there was an email from someone who had seen my article in The Australian. And in the email, the person said, "Where is our democratic state that the majority elected?" Just snippets, give you a feel for what's in this email. Democracy seems to have lost a great deal of the benefits we associated with the free and, open quotes, democratic, close quotes, voting system. He concludes by saying, we seem to be lacking a Socrates to pose the right questions, let alone a statesman or woman to provide the answers. So I got that last night and I thought, okay, very interesting. And then this morning I was taking a meeting of a room full of Australians and I said, we live in a democracy. And I looked around the room and a lot of people were going like this. they were shaking their heads. So this is just the immediate background to what I want to talk about, democracy and its opposite. Now, this man who sent me this email said, we seem to be lacking a Socrates to pose the right questions, let alone statesman, stateswoman, to provide the answers. And I'm sure he knows, that Socrates was actually put to death by the democracy in Athens in 399 BC. I just think that's very significant. I'll stop for a few seconds to allow it to sink in. So for him, the man who's going to rescue the democracy, arrive on the scene, pose all the right questions, did exactly the same thing in 399 BC and for most of his life beforehand, and then they put him to death for that. That's what happened. The story went on, though, for a significant number of years prior to his execution in 399 BC. Plato was an associate of Socrates. You would really say a disciple of Socrates. When Socrates died and was put to death at the age of 70, Plato was 28 and probably had been with Socrates, it could be 10 years, could be longer. He was the most important influence on his life. The death of Socrates devastated Plato. It was the significant turning point in his life and made him reconsider every aspect of the future which had been mapped out for him as a high-born Athenian, where he could make his way in the politics of the time. Because as in societies of that nature, if you're born at the right stratum, politics is just open to you, and that was open to Plato. But that all changed when the death of Socrates took place, when Socrates was executed under such cruel and contrived circumstances. And he turned then to philosophy, not with a view to turning his back upon society, and not with a view to going to the purely contemplative life. No, Plato saw philosophy as a means of benefiting his society, and the only means of benefiting his society. The way to save a society was not politics, but philosophy. Now, you'd probably all agree with me on the not politics part. What is the alternative? Is politics going to save us? One person shook their head. Is philosophy going to save us? Three people said yes. It's an important question. I'm just going to go back to the email that I was sent and all these questions about democracy and this general satisfaction about what's going on in your own country here at the moment. It would be the same in Ireland. It would be the same in any of these countries that I'm familiar with. I'm also going to talk about South Africa later, and you detect exactly the same thing in South Africa. I'll be talking about South Africa. Now, Plato turned to philosophy. And when he turned to philosophy, he did not turn his back on politics. The very democracy which had executed his master, Socrates, always was to the forefront of his mind. Many authors say he hated democracy, that he hated democracy because of what it did to Socrates. But when Plato comes to write his Laws towards the very end of his life, he gives us a very beautiful, very simple framework in which to consider democracy, and I entitled the lecture Democracy and Its Opposite. So there's something else besides democracy. But what he writes in the Laws towards the very end of his life is, it would be right to say that there are, as it were, two mother forms of political systems from which all others arise. One is called monarchy, the other democracy. Now, a city must necessarily have a share in both of these if it is to have freedom and friendship accompanied by wisdom. A city could never be properly governed without a share of these two, the two being monarchy and democracy. The word democracy literally in Greek means rule by the people. The people are the demos. And monarchy is rule by one. Monon is the Greek for one. So two mother forms, rule by one, a single king who's all powerful. Rule by the demos, the people somehow or other contrive a system whereby they run things. But they're the two mother forms and you need both. And no city will have freedom and friendship accompanied by wisdom unless it has a share of these two, namely monarchy and democracy. Now, he immediately goes on from his own time to give an account of how this works in practice and how this is really, really important and what goes wrong when you don't have it. And he's going to focus first upon monarchy, because the Athenians at that time thought they lived in democracy. I know some people in this room question whether they live in a democracy or not. I found that out this morning. But he would not have had to say much about democracy to the Athenians, but he wants to talk about monarchy. And he goes back to the reign of a Persian king called Cyrus. Now, Cyrus reigned long before Plato, 559 to 530 BC. So getting on for 200 years before Plato's time was this king called Cyrus. And what Plato says in the Laws, following on from what I've just read you, what he says in the Laws about Cyrus, the all-powerful king, Cyrus, all-powerful king of Persia, no democracy. There's no democracy. What's more, if anyone among the citizens was wise and capable of offering his advice, the king Cyrus did not begrudge him that opportunity. He allowed free speech and respected those who could assist him in his deliberations. And so the benefit of another man's wisdom was made available to the community at its very heart. In fact, everything prospered for them in those days because of this freedom, friendship, and communal spirit. So there's Cyrus, a monarch, there's no democracy, but he listens. And because he listens, if there's any wisdom available in the community, it's made available to him. So he grants the demos, the people, a voice, and he listens to the people. And that is very, very good for Persia. He's, as he says, there's a spirit of freedom, friendship, and communal spirit. It's fostered by the approach of Cyrus. So this is a very fortunate period for the Persian Empire. Cyrus is universally regarded and admired as a good ruler. He ruled for 29 years and he died leaving two sons. The two sons were designated as joint rulers. One of the sons immediately decided, well, that's not going to happen. So he killed the other one. Yeah, it's true. Plato then, in the same book of the Laws, Laws Book 3, he describes this other son. He describes the two sons and their education. So these are the successors to Cyrus, the, let's call it golden age, bit of an exaggeration of Cyrus, but here's what succeeds. From their very childhood, they were reared as though they were already favoured with the blessings of heaven, with no deficiency. Their tutors would allow no one to oppose the children in anything because they were so blessed. And they made everyone else praise whatever the children said or did. So they brought them up to be people of a particular sort. So they're totally ill-educated. They're just spoilt, entirely used to having their own way and never, ever being accustomed to being opposed. Everyone just has agreed with them all their lives. Suddenly they're ruling, and the process which Cyrus was open to, listen to people, let the wisdom of the community flow into you to help you with your decision making, that would not enter the consciousness of this one surviving brother, son who'd killed his other brother. So suddenly Persia, from a very benign regime under Cyrus, goes into a dark period. So with the monarch, it's the luck of the draw. You get a good ruler, excellent. If he neglects the education of his children, and there's a failing on Cyrus, he didn't educate his sons for rule. And because of that, they just came into power just expecting everyone to say yes to them, and probably were utterly uncomprehending if anyone said anything else. So that was not good for Persia, and it was they went into a dark period after that. Now, what's missing here is obviously some sort of a system whereby what Cyrus did is, as you might put it, a legal or constitutional requirement, that you listen to the people. That brings in the democratic element. The people begin to have a voice. Cyrus gave it to them voluntarily. He was happy to listen. He didn't feel he was omniscient, and he was happy to listen to other people, and he availed of their wisdom. But it was not enforced by law, so when the other son came in and chose not to listen, there was nothing to make him create a popular assembly or any other mechanism whereby he could pick up wisdom from some source other than from himself. So the first thing that Plato says in the Laws as he moves to consider this deficiency, because we've got a problem here. It can't just be the luck of the draw. We need some system whereby we can ensure that what we encountered by chance with Cyrus is the way things are meant to be, and you can't depart from them. So he says in the Laws, we have said that the lawgiver should frame laws with three aims in view, that the city under his laws will be free, friendly towards itself, and possessed of reason. These were the aims, were they not? So that's the aim. The aim of any laws is that the society should be free, wise, and friendly towards itself. Be free, friendly towards itself, and possessed of reason is the words that are here. Free, friendly towards itself, and possessed of reason. That's the general aim of the laws. It's very, very broad brushstroke, so, but what exactly would they set up? The next statement is also in Plato's Laws, this time it's Book 4, and it's a term which is still familiar in constitutional law today. It's the term the rule of law. And it does not mean the rule of law on the streets. It means, as it's put here, when law is subservient and devoid of authority, I see destruction close at hand for such a city. But when law is the master of those in authority, and the rulers are subservient to the law, then I behold salvation and everything good that the gods ever bestow upon cities. So no one is above the law. Even the rulers are under the law, and they are actually servants of the law. They're meant to ensure that the laws are implemented and propagated so that the result of the law is attained and the society is free, wise, and friend to itself. So this is what was missing under the Persian arrangement. There was no such law in place. Whoever was the monarch was supreme. Law was beneath the monarch. In fact, whatever the monarch said, that was law. The idea that the monarch would be under anything was not acceptable. It was not required. I just need to make that clear. It was not required. So Cyrus just saw there's a higher law which says you should listen to people. There's a higher law which says someone might know more than you do. There's a higher law which says someone else might be wiser than you are. Somehow or other, he intuited that, and he heeded that, but it was not written down anywhere, and it was not a requirement. So his son just neglected it and thought he knew best, because that's the way he'd been brought up anyway. So the problem in Persia is just that. There is no law to make any of this happen.
Now seeking applications for benevolent kings. I'm Big Ideas with Natasha Mitchell across the nation on ABC Radio National and everywhere as podcast. This is Dr. David Horan. He's a scholar and translator of Plato from the Irish School of Philosophy and Economic Science. His book, a massive translation exercise, is called The Dialogues of Plato. And Dr. Horan is in dialogue with an eager audience of amateur philosophers at Sydney's School of Practical Philosophy.
Now, I'm going to go on and I'm going to talk about Russia, and then I'm going to go on and I'm going to talk about South Africa. And then I'm going to bring the lecture to a conclusion by bringing this back to the age in which we live, in which I get emails expressing dissatisfaction and I get people nodding their heads this morning when I say we're living in a democracy. So I'm back to the question at the very end, what will remedy our ills now? But I would like to stop just there because there's quite a lot in what I've said, just to hear if there's anything in the room by way of response to that, and it just gives me a feel for how you're hearing this and where I should take it. So anything immediately you wish to say in response to any of that? I'm just going to stop for a few minutes here just to see. Yes, go ahead.
What are the attributes of the reason that they need to possess?
Yes, it's a very good question. Yeah, what is the attributes of the reason which law will help to bring about, and that the state will be under reason, because it's too broad a statement to constitute a law. Write down something like, we're going to be reasonable. Okay. Cyrus would say, Yeah, I mean, I've done my best and I've taken precautions. And his son would probably say, there's no one more reasonable than me. What are you talking about? So somehow or other, when you get to the level of law, they need to reflect and capture reason. And that's quite a challenge. But if I go back to, in general, it's reasonable to give the people you govern a say. That's just reasonable. It may not be the most exalted reason of all, just a simple thing.
Is there any other historical example of a loss such as the one you've just described? Some other ruler who did not educate his sons?
Yeah, can you think of one? I think if you look at the dynasties, you get good kings and bad kings. And what makes the difference? It's their character. But you need somehow or other to be prepared to rule. At one stage in Ireland, the Plato Centre in Trinity College invited the members of the Senate, and that's the lower house in Ireland, to come in to hear about Plato. They all came in and heard about Plato, and they were taught about the fact that Plato, in his Republic, explains how the rulers will be educated. And some of them very honestly said, gosh, no one educated us for this job. Suddenly we were here, we were senators, but we had not been prepared for this. So it's a really important point in general. You want to educate your rulers. If you don't, you're going to have problems, even with a constitution in place. And I'm going to talk about that in a moment. So look, I'm going to stop it there and move on. I'll now do Russia, which is very, very interesting. I've been very interested in Russia. I've been reading about the Russian Revolution. I've been reading Dostoevsky for several years. And there's a recent book published by a woman called Susanna Rabo Edling, and it's called The First Russian Revolution. So exactly December, 200 years ago, was the First Russian Revolution, what Susanna Rabo Edling calls the First Russian Revolution. And I've been reading her book, and it's a very, very interesting book and very, very well written. And what happened there was, goes back to a strange sequence of events. Napoleon invaded Russia in 1812. The 1812 Overture doesn't celebrate the invasion, it celebrates his expulsion. He got to Moscow. You probably know the rest of the story, but in very simple terms, he was defeated by the Russians. The Russians chased him out, and they chased him out as far as Paris. They got right as far as Paris. In 1814, the Russian Tsar, the Russian Emperor, was in Paris, the victor over Napoleon, the only nation that was able to defeat Napoleon and bring him down. And the officers were there, and they were in a totally different world. They could not believe what they were seeing around them, and in particular, the freedoms. And when they came back to their own country, Russia, they thought, oh my heavens, what a contrast. And here's a little quotation from Susanna Rabo Edling's book. She talks about one man. Yakushin wrote that his stay abroad during the military campaigns first drew my attention to Russia's social structure and compelled me to see its defects. The young officers could now compare all that they had seen abroad with what confronted them at home. Slavery of the majority of Russians, cruel treatment of subordinates by their superiors, all kinds of government abuses and general tyranny. The army, from generals to privates, upon its return, did nothing but discuss how good it is in foreign lands. Betsushev recalls, a comparison with their own country naturally brought up the question, why is it not so here? Did we liberate Europe in order to fasten its chains upon ourselves? The Decembrists later recalled the anger they felt when the peasants who had been fighting against Napoleon returned to Russia and were once again forced into serfdom. After fighting alongside regular soldiers, the officers felt strongly for these unfortunate people. And Russia at that time had serfdom. The serfs were not liberated until 1861, many years after this. And when the serfs were liberated in Russia, the population of Russia was about 60 million. 20 million were serfs. That really means slaves. You belonged to people. And your wealth was measured on how many serfs you owned. You could quote, I own 1,000 serfs. So that was the position of Russia. They came back and they began lobbying the Tsar for two things which are very significant in terms of democracy and its opposite. You definitely have monarchy. The two mother forms are monarchy and democracy. You've got one man, the Tsar, and that's monarchy. You get all of the abuses that go with it. Here's the condition of Russia under monarchy. What they said to him was, please, can we have a democratic assembly of some sort with some power even to make recommendations to you, even if they can't enforce them? And also, and this was really a red rag to a bull, could we have a written constitution, basically reading between the lines, to which you will be subject, the Tsar will be subject? Remember what Plato said, where law is subservient and devoid of authority, I see destruction close at hand for such a city. But when law is master of those in authority, they wanted a written constitution, laws that would be master of those in authority, namely the Tsar. What do you think his answer was? You get it. They wouldn't hear of it. They would not hear of it. Now, back to Cathy's question about divine. They were brought up. The upbringing was such that you are there appointed by God to rule Russia. It's the next step above the Tsar is God. It will never, ever happen that the next step above the Tsar is a written constitution, and that the Tsar would be compelled to listen to any democratic assembly of any kind. So he just drew a line. Even though he had condoned a written constitution for Poland and for France after they left France. And they were really hopeful when they saw that. He's done it for Poland. He's done it for France. He seems to have no problem there. Surely he will do it for us in Russia. So they kept lobbying, they formed secret societies. It was all an officer inner circle, mainly aristocrats and officers. Not a peasant, well, there was never going to be a peasant revolt. Eventually they waited, they did a lot of talking, they did a lot of planning. There was a bit of division between them. Some people said, no, we're just looking for constitutional reform, we're looking for what we would call a parliamentary democracy. Others were saying, no, there's only one way to do this. We've got to kill the Tsar. So that was the conflict between the revolutionaries. Eventually, that's 1814, they come back from Paris. They wait. I've told you the revolution's 1825, so that's 11 years later. And it was over many years after Napoleon invaded. And eventually, in 1825, the Tsar dies. That's Tsar Alexander I. He died young. He was not yet 50. And there was also a dispute and confusion over who his successor was going to be, because he did have two sons, but one of them didn't want it. And the other son didn't know that the other guy didn't want it. So things got a bit confused, and they said, this is our golden opportunity. Absolutely golden opportunity. They really, in their heart of hearts, knew that they were simply going to die in a good cause. They're very noble people with very noble aspirations, and they knew their chances of success were slim. And sure enough, the revolution was suppressed within days. And the Tsars thereafter attempted to erase it from history so the people didn't know about it. But the later revolutionaries and Lenin and Trotsky and the later people who brought about the successful revolution, they were quite aware of it. Although they did laugh at it as the sort of the popular revolution without the populace, which it was. It was an upper class revolution. So there again is an attempt to put in place a democracy alongside the monarchy and a system of laws to govern it all and make it all happen, and everything is under those laws. The training of the Tsars was such that right to the very end, they simply would not grant these concessions. And even when under the Nicholas II, the last of the Romanovs, he allowed them to form a Duma, a People's Assembly, but it was dissolvable at his will. All he had to do is say, It's gone, and it was gone. And there was no written constitution. There might have been a document, but again, that document could be set aside at the whim of the Tsar. So the idea in that really important quotation, when law is master of those in authority and the rulers are subservient to the law, I behold salvation and everything good that the gods ever bestow upon cities. So the Tsars resisted this to the very, very end. And even in 1917, early 1917, the Tsar's ultimate solution to the chaos that was unfolding around him was to abdicate. So 1917, early 1917, the Tsar abdicates. There's then a provisional government and, you know, a lot of chaos and a lot of confusion in Russia. But this balance was playing out for hundreds of years in Russia, with people just pointing to Plato's principle, monarchy plus democracy and all under law. And it was resisted. Now, South Africa. Very recent example, and a modern constitution, the South African constitution. And I'm going to talk about a woman called Thuli Madonsela, who was appointed by Jacob Zuma as public protector. And in her role as public protector, under Article 9, Chapter 9 of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, she has the power, as regulated by national legislation, to investigate any conduct in state affairs or in the public administration of any sphere of government that is alleged or suspected to be improper or the result of any impropriety or prejudice. So she is appointed to this role. She's appointed to the role by Jacob Zuma. And, you know, the way these things work, I appoint you to the role. You need to remember who gave you that job. But she didn't. There was a great scandal unfolding in South Africa at the time of the amount of money that Zuma had spent upon his private residence, come fortress, come palace. And it was definitely an abuse. And she investigated this abuse by Zuma. She finished her report, which was negative towards Zuma, and found that he had been guilty of improper conduct. She finished that report in 2013. She was put under huge pressure to, you know, burn it, lose it, don't make trouble, this is not going to go anywhere. So she waited a year and she published it. And such strength. She has the law in place, the written constitution of South Africa. She's operating under that. She has got a democratic mandate and she's the public protector. She's protecting the democracy, the demos. She's protecting the people. That's her job. Zuma is on the other side, the monarch, and monarchs will always try it. It's just in their nature. They'll always try just, why don't you just go away? Why don't you remember who gave you this job? Why don't you just burn that report? Because you're only going to make trouble for everyone, even more so for yourself. This is the play that's going on. She still makes no headway, even though she's published the report. Not much is happening. She was listed as Time Magazine's list of the world's most 100 influential people, and I haven't written down the year, around this time, 2013, 14, 15, probably more 14, 15, because she didn't publish the report until 2014. So having failed to get anywhere with the report in circulation, because all Zuma's going to say is, it's not true, it's not true, it's not true, I didn't do anything, I'm not corrupt, she then takes a court case. And she wins the court case. And they find Zuma has operated improperly. He's the president of South Africa. And they find in favour of Thuli Madonsela, doesn't look that formidable. But my God, Zuma didn't know what he was taking on. I have a quotation from the judgment of Chief Justice Magoeng Magoeng, who was also a Zuma appointee and was supposed to toe the line and remember who gave him this job. Your Chief Justice, big job. Congratulations. Remember who gave it to you. Didn't work. They sided with law. Quotation from the judgment. One of the crucial elements of our constitutional vision is to make a decisive break from the unchecked abuse of state power and resources that was virtually institutionalized during the apartheid era. To achieve this goal, we adopted accountability, the rule of law, Plato's Laws, Book 4, The Rule of Law, and the supremacy of the Constitution as values of our constitutional democracy. For this reason, public office bearers ignore their constitutional obligations at their peril. This is so because constitutionalism, accountability, and the rule of law constitute the sharp and mighty sword that stands ready to chop the ugly head of impunity off its stiffened neck. You get the message, Mr. Zuma? That was 2016, the date of the judgment, 2016. He stepped down in 2018. And his own party, the ANC, turned against him. So there it is. It's an extraordinary story. And it's the same forces playing out. Now, we've got the three elements in place, but it's quite a battle. It's quite a battle. You don't just put a constitution in place and suddenly you're in the promised land. It took Thuli Madonsela and her courage and her doggedness and Justice Magoeng Magoeng to realise, I'm the Chief Justice. I'm not a right-hand man of Jacob Zuma. He stood by justice. She stood by her fidelity to her role as public protector. And because of that, Zuma was brought down. You can dramatically say, some people would challenge it, but she's the woman who brought down Jacob Zuma. And she just was relentless. She was not going to let go. So there it is. That's the Russian example of how all of this plays out, and a more modern example of how all of this plays out. Both of them quite dramatic, both very, very dramatic. And that drama in Russia, of course, went on from 1825 right through to the 1905 revolution, which really was not very successful, ended in Bloody Sunday and the massacre, and then 1917, which just ushered in more chaos, unfortunately. But nevertheless, the Tsar was gone.
Power of the rule of law, as recognised by Plato more than 2,000 years ago, but ignored by many leaders since. Hey, and Irish scholar Dr. David Horan has spent the past 16 years translating the complete works of Plato, as you do. He joins you on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen today with me, Natasha Mitchell. Dr. Horan is with an audience as well at the School of Practical Philosophy in Sydney.
So let me just stop there again. I've given you some examples and I'm showing you how this works and how this actually plays out in practice. That's what Plato did in the Laws. He gave you the examples of Cyrus. They're slightly dated at this stage, and so I just thought I'd update them. So we've done Russia and we've done South Africa. Anything immediately in your minds to say, and you'll have to wait for a microphone.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Horan. With the ancient Greek situation where the laws were developed in 400 or so BC, it was pre-Christian and not really a monotheistic society. I'm pretty sure the Tsar would be closely connected to the Orthodox religion and perhaps consider himself the head of that, and therefore God is his authority, and it would be very difficult to usher in secular laws arising from secularism to be above him if that relationship was considered pure and truthful to the people.
Yes, he would manipulate that relationship with the church. He would manipulate that relationship with the church to his own ends. That's why Marx, when Marx arrives on the scene, he said, look, what the churches are another basis of supporting and giving spiritual credence to an economic system and a social system. Social system, economic system comes first, and out of it then grow these institutions such as churches to support them. If you look at what goes on in Russia, you could justify what Marx said. That is what they were doing. They were just in the pocket of the Tsar, and that undermined the authority of the Orthodox Church. It is amazing what the Greeks achieved. We owe a great debt of gratitude towards those people in that part of the world at that time for what they achieved and what they gave the world. When Greece was seeking independence from Turkey, a lot of the Western thinkers said, we owe these people a huge debt of gratitude because they invented democracy and they invented these institutions and they invented the rule of law. Now, whether all that's open to challenge, nevertheless, that's the spirit of this. We owe them a great debt of gratitude. So I'm very happy to go back to Plato. And Plato will invoke the divine. He begins the laws with a question. Was it a god or some human that was the author of your laws? That's the question at the start of the laws. Was it a god or some human that was the author of your laws? Now, you need to realise, of course, that it's an inquiry. It's a constant inquiry. You shouldn't assume that Plato says in Book 1 of the Laws that the laws are authored by God. But you shouldn't assume he doesn't believe it either. It's an inquiry. Where does the divine, where does a supreme power and authority fit into this, and how should it operate? And how can we avoid manipulation such as was going on in Tsarist Russia? Anything else in the room? There's a hand.
Hello.
There. Yeah, great.
Yeah, my name's Stuart. So the South African example you mentioned, was that an attempt at direct democracy?
What they call it is constitutionalism with accountability and the rule of law. You know the way the South African system works. I mean, that there are elections, there's a parliament, and there's a very, very strong president and a very, very strong executive function exercisable through the president. That's the way they set it up. And look, there's always a question here. There's always a serious question. Soon as you put a written constitution in place, soon as you put any written law in place, there's going to be people reading it, looking for ways around it. That's just the way. Tax law, there's people who make a living telling you how to get around it. It's a very strange business. This is all very dynamic. You could put that under the side of the democracy. I mean, fine, you've got this written constitution, but the people want to do something else. And it's our country. So I don't want to be very black and white about all of this. These are very great universal forces which are at play. And the ones I want to pick are, they're really important. The monarchic aspect, that's what you have in the person of Jacob Zuma. But he should be under the law. And just because you're the monarch doesn't mean you can spend literally millions on your private dwelling. I can't do that. Monarch doesn't mean that. And then you have the people and the people's protector on the other hand, who sees this happen and say, this is all wrong. But the story, the way I tell it, that's not enough. That'll go on forever. Because all the monarch is going to say is, he's probably thinking, look, who's monarch? I'm monarch. What does monarch mean? I'm the man. What he will actually say when he gets to speak is, no, I didn't, there was no corruption. But behind it is, look, this democracy's a nuisance. And so is this written constitution. So someone needs to stand up for them and defend them. Ideally, it's the courts, and that's the way it worked in South Africa. And if you can do it this way, you avoid revolutions on the streets. If you can get this to work, you avoid revolutions on the streets. But none of it's neat, and it's all hard work. So there it is. Now, I'm just going to keep going. Let me finish now. The day and age in which we live. And I have a formulation here. I gave it yesterday at the book launch. I've said it quite a lot recently. And I just think it's Plato's message to the world in which we live. I'm back to Plato. We've been reading his laws. You've got quotations from his laws there. But what I translated, it's on the cover of the book. And if you don't want to read the translations, I really don't care. But just have a quick look at the cover of the book. It's the dialogues of Plato. The dialogues of Plato. Not the teachings of Plato. The dialogues of Plato. Not the philosophy of Plato. It's the dialogues. And what screams out from every page of Plato is dialogue and discourse. Dialogue and discourse. And a further step of a remarkable achievement on Plato's part of being able to understand the views of people with whom he radically disagrees, being able to understand the views of people who really threaten society and threaten the good order of society. So instead of just railing against them, the first step he takes is to understand them. And if you read the dialogues, you'll find you begin to be told where these people are coming from. These troublemakers, these problematic people, these people who want nothing to do with justice, the Jacob Zumas of this world, who really, as soon as you write a constitution, the question is, okay, how do we get around this? And you begin with even the idea of appoint the right people. Thuli Madonsela, young woman, she'll cause no trouble. Magoeng, known him for years, good guy, he'll know who appointed him. Wrong on both counts. So they're the remarkable aspects of these dialogues. The rest is detail, and the detail's important, but dialogue and discourse and understand people, really understand people, even if you're appalled by them, even if you're appalled by their views, really understand people. Now, so what does this society do? I have a story told about Plato and Socrates. And the story is a later story, is from Diogenes Laertius, long after Plato and Socrates was gone. But I'll paraphrase the story for you as follows. The story is that Socrates had a dream. And in this dream, a young swan, a cygnet, was given to him. The cygnet, because they're brown wings, immediately turned white, grew full plumage, and flew away, uttering a loud, sweet note. The next day, Plato was brought to Socrates as a pupil, and Socrates says, "Ah, that's the swan whom I saw in my dream." So, Socrates' swan is Plato, and it flies away, uttering a loud, sweet note. Now, I have several questions about this. I love the story. I have several questions about it. Why did the swan fly away? Why didn't it just stay there with the master, fluttering around and being a pet swan? Why did it fly away? What was the loud, sweet note? How far did the swan fly, and for how long? And is it flying still? So, this is the start of another lecture. So to cut it short, it can fly still. It can fly to this day. And if that swan flies to this day, the world will be much the better for it. And if people ignore the swan and want to bring the swan down, the world will be the worse for it. And the reason for that is that the swan, Plato, stands for dialogue and discourse in a world of people who don't want to talk to each other. And the swan has a loud, sweet sound. And dogma is not loud and sweet. Dogma is harsh. So it's the sound of, let me say, truth, as opposed to dogma. The sound that unites rather than divides. Now, you might think, what harm does dogma do? Sounds like just words. So I end very dramatically with a quotation which I've been carrying around with me for months. And I keep saying I won't use it. It's too dramatic. And just today, something said, use it. So here goes. Some of you may have seen a BBC series called The Ascent of Man, which aired in the 70s. I watched it and I loved it. The presenter was Jacob Bronowski. Bronowski was Polish, and he himself got out of Poland and out of that part of Europe as the Nazis came in. Many members of his family did not, and he lost many members of his family in the death camps. As part of that series, The Ascent of Man, he goes back to Auschwitz to make a point. And he says the following. It is said that science will dehumanize people and turn them into numbers. This is false, tragically false. Look for yourselves. Here is the cremation camp and concentration camp at Auschwitz. This is where people were turned into numbers. Into this pond were flushed the ashes of some 4 million people. And that was not done by gas. It was done by arrogance. It was done by dogma. It was done by ignorance. When people believe that they have absolute knowledge with no test in reality, this is how they behave. This is what men do when they aspire to the knowledge of gods. I owe it as a scientist to my friend Leo Szilard. I owe it as a human being to the many members of my family who died in Auschwitz. To stand here by the pond as a survivor and a witness. We have to cure ourselves of the itch for absolute knowledge and power. We have to close the distance between the push-button order and the human act. We have to touch people. So it's a powerful message. And Plato, standing against dogma, stands against what happened in those years. It was not done by gas. It was done by arrogance. It was done by dogma. It was done by ignorance. That's a harsh sound. And Plato's loud, sweet note stands against that to dissolve that harsh sound. And if somehow or other that sound can prevail in our society, things will be very, very different. Thank you very, very much. It's been wonderful to talk to you.
Certainly, many of us are grasping for Socrates' white swan today. And what a beautiful, loud, sweet philosophical note to end on. With Dr. David Horan, leader of the School of Philosophy and Economic Science in Ireland, member of the Plato Centre at Trinity College Dublin, and author of the epic two-volume, The Dialogues of Plato, a 16-year project to translate the ancient Greek philosopher's complete works. Congratulations on that achievement, sir. And thanks to Sydney's School of Practical Philosophy for that event. Next on Big Ideas, join me, Natasha Mitchell, with Lisa Wilkinson. You know her from your television screens as Walkley Award-winning journalist and presenter. She's authored a new book, and it's a cracker, about the Titanic.
One of the things I discovered in doing that research is that, like so much of history, our history is told by men. And everything that I was seeing on the Titanic was stories being told by men. So I knew that there was an opportunity there when I discovered that there were so many incredible women on the Titanic. There were 434 of them. And they were everything from political activists to the highest paid, most famous movie star in the world at the time, the most celebrated fashion designer in Paris at the time, a big game hunter, don't condone, but wow, big game hunter, female at the turn of the century is extraordinary.
On the Titanic. Yeah.
Suffragettes, these incredible women. And I couldn't understand why their collective story had never been told, but I also knew that they were going to help me tell Evelyn's story. But the day came when I discovered that one of Evelyn's most precious relatives was still alive. She had a favourite niece, Mavis, and Mavis's daughter is still alive. She's 76 years of age. She lives in South Australia, and she was my absolute connection to Evelyn, because Patria holds all of the letters and all of the family folklore.
That is an absolute gift. She's the sole survivor of...
No, there are other family members, but Patria, because she was Evelyn's favourite niece's daughter, Mavis passed on all of that family folklore to Patria. And Patria has held Evelyn close to her heart all of her life.
And, so, the precious gift of an archive. So she gave you access to that archive.
An archive that no one else has ever seen.
Oh, that's incredible.
A riveting story and an event I shared with Lisa Wilkinson. That's next on Big Ideas. My name is Natasha Mitchell. You can email me and the show at bigideas@abc.net.au. We love hearing from you. Big Ideas is all about giving you a front row seat to the best live events. So suggest any that you know are coming up. And if you love us, leave us a review on podcast apps and share us with your friends. I'll catch you next time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.